through the section of the sutta which explores the chain of conditions that make up dependent origination of each samskara. And so far we have gone all the ways from
together are called form, and
then name and form always go together as a compound. So we have, in terms of the physical organism, the cognitive component, which is name or nama, the mental functions involved in naming, designation, conceptualization, and the bodily form, which is the basis for the mental functions. Okay, so this is name and form, and the text says with the arising of consciousness, there is the arising of name and form. And we saw last time the way this can be, this statement can best be understood through a passage which comes in the Mahanidana Sutta, the great discourse on causation. This is the first paragraph on the handout sheet. Here the Buddha is speaking to Venerable Ananda, and he explains how consciousness is a condition for name and form. This should be understood in this way. If consciousness does not descend into the mother's womb, name and form would not take shape in the womb. So in order for the complex of the mental and physical factors even to arise in the form of an embryo, it's necessary for consciousness. This would be the stream of consciousness coming over from a being who has passed away. And so that stream of consciousness is, speaking metaphorically, it's waiting for the ideal set of conditions to arise for it to take rebirth and begin the process of a new life. And so when these conditions come together, when there is a woman who has just been, her egg has just been fertilized, and the being who is seeking rebirth has the right karmic conditions with his family and this living situation, then that consciousness will, speaking metaphorically, descends into the womb where it arises based upon that newly fertilized egg and begins the life process. And that life process actually begins as, so we can describe the beginning of the life process as name and form starting to take shape in the womb. That is when consciousness comes down and unites with this fertilized egg, then the matter of that egg turns into a bodily form, even if it's a single cell. And then when consciousness links up with that fertilized cell, it also brings along with it the various mental functions, occurring in a very, very simple way. Even at that very moment of conception, there is some feeling, some perception, some volition, some contact, some attention. Okay, so this is the way name and form arises in the womb, through consciousness descending into the womb. Okay, if, the second case, if after descending into the womb, consciousness departs, if some accident takes place, something takes place to cut off the life of that being, then the consciousness leaves. That's the way death is described, the cutting off of the stream of consciousness. And then name and form would not be generated into this present state of being. The name and form that constitutes the developing embryo will not continue to grow and develop, and a full birth will not take place. Okay, after the being has been born, a young boy, a young girl, the being continues through this interplay, this mutually dependent relationship between consciousness and name and form. Consciousness operating based upon the physical body, and through cognition, through its acts of cognition, inevitably, necessarily involve the factors of nama. some feeling, some perception, some volition, contact and attention. So that is the process of life going on through the whole course of development of a living being. But if the life of this young boy or girl is ended, this is spoken of as the consciousness being cut off. And if that occurs, then nama-rupa, name and form, would not grow, develop, and reach maturity. Okay, so in this way, consciousness is a condition for name and form. And if there's some interruption to the stream of consciousness, then name and form will not grow and develop. Okay, this is as far as we got the last time. Okay, so now we move on to the next section. So now we come to paragraph 58. What is consciousness? What is the origin of consciousness? What is the cessation of consciousness? What is the way leading to the cessation of consciousness? Okay, so now the text answers the first question simply by enumerating these six types of consciousness. So, what is consciousness? There are these, unfortunately the text never really defines what consciousness is. This is the way these ancient texts work. They don't give the kind of clear conceptual definitions that we would expect from a textbook of cognitive science. But instead what they give is just enumerations of the types, the subtypes under a particular category. Okay, so what is consciousness? There are these six classes of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. The word that's translated as consciousness, it comes, in Pali it's vijnana.
Experiences or knows
then the consciousness which knows internal objects, ideas, concepts, judgments, propositions, decisions, all the objects of images, internal images, the consciousness which knows all of these purely internal objects is called mind consciousness. But mind consciousness, as I explained earlier, can also know the objects of the other senses. It's mind consciousness. The eye consciousness just sees forms, but it doesn't distinguish what these forms represent. It just takes in color and shape, but the eye consciousness will distinguish, the mind consciousness, based upon what's the data brought in through the eye consciousness, will then distinguish this is a cup, this is a book. So the eye consciousness just brings in colored form. And the mind consciousness labels that form, identifies it, apprehends it conceptually. Okay, so these are the six classes of consciousness. And this whole process of consciousness, one act of consciousness after another, arising and passing, trace back, this goes all the ways to this first occasion when consciousness descends into the mother's womb, bringing along name and form. But what is it that is responsible for driving or directing consciousness to a particular state within the womb? What is it that determines the particular realm in which consciousness will take rebirth? What is it that underlies the consciousness and gives it a direction which impels it or moves it towards one state or another state? According to the Buddha's teaching, this is what is called sankhara, which we translate here as volitional formations. Maybe not fully satisfactory. Sankhara is derived from the prefix san, which gives a sense of together. It's a little bit like the English prefix con, C-O-N, or com, C-O-N. And the verbal root kar, which means to do or to make. So sankharas are things which make, which working together create, make, produce other things. They are the basic forces, you see, the forces of actuality. Or the actual forces that constitute elements of experience. And the word sankhara is used in the Buddhist text with several different nuances. But in relation to dependent origination, sankhara is understood to be, well, it's the karmic activities that create karma. And so the key mental factor in the arising of sankharas is volition, which is why I translated it as volition. considered from the standpoint of being karma, the factor responsible for creating karma. Volition is the factor that determines the direction of consciousness. It is the factor that propels consciousness from one state to another state, from one realm to another realm. And to see how this works, to illustrate how sankharas become the condition for consciousness, I want to take a number of... Well, first let us jump ahead in the sutta. Okay, from paragraph 58, go to paragraph 62, just in order to get to the question, what are volitional formations? And so the text gives the answer. There are these three kinds of volitional formations: the bodily volitional formation, the verbal volitional formation, and the mental volitional formation. So the sankharas are distinguished according to these three types, depending on the particular door of action through which they arise. So bodily actions are called volition expressing itself as bodily action is the bodily volitional form. Expresses itself in speech, in terms as verbal actions, verbal activities. This is the verbal volitional formation. And then states of volition that remain purely internal, emotions, thoughts, desires, and so on, but don't come to outer expression, either through body or speech. These are called the mental volitional formation. And so we have volitional formations of body, of speech, and of mind. Another way of distinguishing the volitional formations that we meet in the text is according to their ethical quality. And so this is what we find in a sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. It's on the handout sheet. This is Samyutta Nikaya 1251, in the bottom of the page. According to this scheme, the volitional formations are distinguished as being meritorious, demeritorious, or imperturbable. The meritorious volitional formations, those would be any kind of volitions which are expressed as wholesome deeds, wholesome bodily, verbal, or mental deeds. Wholesome actions, wholesome words, and wholesome thoughts, wholesome emotions, wholesome mental states. And it's said that the meritorious volitional formation includes, we speak about the 10 ways of wholesome action: not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, not lying, not speaking divisive speech, not speaking harshly, engaging in idle chatter, non-covetousness, non-ill will, quiet view. So all of that makes up meritorious volition. And also, even the volition which is involved in the practice of meditation, this is also meritorious. second type is the demeritorious volitional formation. And this would be the volition involved in any type of unwholesome activity. The volition that lies behind killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, false speech, slander, and so on. Any type of unwholesome deeds, that volition is called the demeritorious volitional formation. The third type is a little more difficult to understand. This is called the imperturbable volitional formation. And this is explained as the volition that is involved in higher meditative absorptions, what are called the formless meditative absorptions. We have these four formless attainments: the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. You don't have to worry about those particular designations. But these are very, very lofty states of samadhi. They're not states of wisdom or insight, but states of very peaceful, tranquil concentration. And those states, because they're so peaceful, so tranquil, they are called imperturbable. And the volitional formations which are present in those states of deep samadhi are called the imperturbable volitional formation. Okay, so now the text tells us, if we look at the text itself, it says, if a person immersed in ignorance, there's still ignorance present, avijja, generates a meritorious volitional formation, then consciousness fares on to the meritorious. That is, when one does the meritorious deed, then consciousness becomes pervaded or permeated by the meritorious quality of that deed. And that creates within this consciousness a potential, a kind of potency, which directs consciousness to a higher realm of rebirth, a fortunate state of rebirth, what we call a state of rebirth, a meritorious state of rebirth. So this would be rebirth under good conditions, satisfactory conditions as a human being, or rebirth in the deva realms, the realms of the deities, or rebirth in the Brahma realm, the realm of the higher divinities. If one generates a demeritorious volitional formation, if one engages in some unwholesome conduct, then consciousness fares on to the demeritorious. That is, the consciousness partakes of the unwholesome quality of one's action. Because that unwholesome volition spreads out to the consciousness itself, and it imparts a kind of dark, defiling quality to the consciousness. And as a result of that pervasion of consciousness by this demeritorious quality, then in the next life, consciousness fares on to the demeritorious. It moves towards a demeritorious type of rebirth. This would be rebirth either under difficult and painful conditions as a human being, or else in one of the lower realms of rebirth. Okay, then the third case, if one generates an imperturbable volitional formation, then consciousness bears on to the imperturbable. So if one attains, experiences, masters one of these imperturbable meditative attainments, one of these formless meditative attainments, then the consciousness becomes permeated by that very peaceful, very tranquil quality of that samadhi. And because the consciousness has been permeated by this peaceful, tranquil quality of the samadhi, then when death takes place, providing one still retains this formless meditation close to the time of death, when death takes place, then consciousness will move to an imperturbable mode of rebirth. That is, it will tend to take rebirth in one of the four formless realms of existence. The base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, either perception or non-perception. Base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, realm of nothingness, realm of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, so this is the way in which, or at least one way in which, volition is a condition for consciousness. Another interesting passage is the one which I cite just above that. It's Sahita Nikaya 1239. It's not so perfectly clear, but I'll read it and then explain it, or at least give my interpretation of it. Okay, the Buddha says, monks, what one intends, and what one plans, and whatever one has a tendency towards, this becomes a basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is a basis, there is a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is a descent of name and form. And with name and form as condition, the six sense bases come to be, and so on down to birth, aging and death, sorrow, limitation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Okay, going back to the first line, what one intends. Here the verb is chaitati, which implies chaitana volition. Okay, the word that's translated, what one intends, is yam chaitati. Now this verb chaitati is related to the noun chaitana. Chaitana is what is translated as volition. And volition is the main factor in sankhara. And then the word expression what one plans in Pali is patka peti. It's really almost synonymous with chaiteti. So both of them together can be taken to imply sankhara. So when there are sankhara present, then the expression or the phrase, whatever one has a tendency towards, this is a way of rendering just one word in Pali, pressing towards yang anusaiti. The verb anusaiti means to have a tendency towards. And this implies the noun anusaya, or actually it's related. It's the verb from which we derive the noun anusaya. Anusaya is the underlying tendency. And among the underlying tendencies, the anusaya, we find the most important are ignorance and craving. Okay, so the way I would understand this text, what one intends and what one plans, that is the sankhara. Those phrases point to the sankharas. And whatever one has a tendency towards, this implies ignorance and craving. So this becomes a basis for the maintenance of consciousness, or for the continuation of consciousness. So this combination, or say this cooperative partnership of the sankharas and ignorance and craving, together these provide the basis for consciousness to continue from life to life. There are basis for consciousness to continue. So when there is a basis, what we establish in this life through our volitional activities, we establish this basis through our deluded volitional activities. Then these activities create a support for the establishing of consciousness. They create the conditions for consciousness to take root in a new existence. That is the establishing of consciousness. Then when consciousness becomes established in a new existence and starts to grow, then nama-rupa, name and form, descend. In other words, the new living organism springs up, constituted by name and form, functioning together with consciousness. And then from name and form, the six sense bases emerge, and then from the six senses, contact, feeling, the new craving, clinging, new karmically creative existence, then birth, aging, and death. Okay, so these are just a few additional texts that I wanted to cite to illustrate how the sankharas function as a condition for consciousness. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions, comments. Okay, please. Maybe if there's the other microphone, please take that.
About the cycle of death and rebirth. It seems like
pay for it.
This is a pretty basic question. This sounds a lot like the first step on the no-label path. Could I bargain some that it is at dependent origination? A right under great views with an understanding of dependent origination?
Well, right view in the no-label path is always explained as understanding the Four Noble Truths, right? So, dependent origination is actually a more elaborate, you'd say, a more elaborate presentation of the Four Noble Truths. So, I would say one could still have, in my opinion, one could still have right view if one understands the Four Noble Truths. One might not be able to understand, or perhaps one doesn't have to understand, the detailed sequence of conditions that make up dependent origination. But I think as one goes on investigating, then that initial right view will start to become deepened and extended so that one can then bring in more aspects of dependent origination.
Bhante, is this consciousness similar to the soul or the Atman in Hinduism?
Okay, is the consciousness similar to the soul or the Atman in Hinduism? Yeah, the consciousness is actually, it's not the same as the soul or the Atman of Hinduism, because the Atman of Hinduism is a single entity which always retains its identity. It remains the same entity eternally. So the basic belief of at least many schools of Hinduism is that in the depths of the living being there is an eternal core, an essence which is eternal, everlasting, indestructible, which always remains the same, and that is the Atman. And in the Hindu understanding, or the Brahmanic understanding of rebirth, the Atman is what transmigrates from one life to the next. The Bhagavad Gita, one of the important Indian scriptures, compares the Atman to a person who can put on one suit of clothes, then remove them, put on another suit of clothes, then replace them with another suit of clothes. The person always remains the same, but it's just the suits of clothing that differ. And so the Atman always remains the same, eternal, imperishable, indestructible, but it just puts on one body, one personality, then in death it casts off that personality, takes on another personality, another, but it always remains the same entity. According to the Buddha's teaching, consciousness is always changing, arising and passing away. It always depends upon conditions. There's visual consciousness, eye consciousness, ear consciousness. Each type of consciousness depends upon certain conditions external to itself. But according to the Buddha's teaching, the succession of consciousness goes on from life to life. And so, as long as ignorance and craving have not been abandoned, not been removed, then when death takes place, this, what I call the stream of consciousness, or the process of consciousness, will continue. It will spring up based upon some new physical organism coming into being, and it will start again the process of birth, growth, aging, and death. And so it's a stream of conscious experience that goes on from life to life, but it's not one single self-identical entity.
Consciousness carried from this life to the next life, the tendency, the underlying tendency, the intention, the the third being,
yep.
All those things go together.
Well, individual acts of intention, individual plans and so on don't carry over from life to life. But what we would say is that when we perform activities, when we engage in any kind of volitional activities, our actions create tendencies within the mind, which eventually will become habits and then traits of character. And so we say the complex of these character traits, tendencies, inclinations, dispositions, this migrates from one life to the next along with the consciousness. So this is basically why people have different characters. One person might have a very emotional character, one person a very artistic character, one person a very aggressive character, another person a very intellectual character. People have different talents, abilities, skills, interests, aptitudes. All of this, I mean, some of it develops in this life itself, but we could see, even in little newborn babies, different character traits already appearing. So one baby, maybe even just a few days after birth, maybe even the day of birth, shows some kind of curiosity, interest, activity. Another baby is just very quiet and passive. Another baby is composing musical compositions. Another baby is working out the theory of relativity.
Thank you. Can I understand in this way, as long as the consciousness stream exists, the ignorance and craving also exist?
Not completely, because ignorance and craving can be eliminated. They're eliminated by the Arhat or by the Buddha. But the Arhat, the Buddha, still has consciousness up to the point it was passing away.
When you pass away, the consciousness springs up. Or turn into something.
I think what I would say is that it becomes nirvana. It becomes, speaking metaphorically, it becomes nirvana.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, then we will go on to the next step in the series. Okay, so now we come to paragraph 62. Okay. So what are volitional formations? What is the origin of volitional formations? What is the cessation of volitional formations? What is the way leading to the cessation of volitional formations? So there are these three kinds of volitional formations. We've already gone through that. With the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of volitional formations. With the cessation of ignorance, there is the cessation of volitional formations. And the way leading to the cessation of volitional formations is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so this passage points out that ignorance, avijja, is the underlying condition for the arising of volitional formations. Even though one performs wholesome deeds, wholesome actions, but it is still the presence of ignorance that converts those wholesome deeds into a kind of karma, that gives those wholesome deeds the capacity to create karma that will propel the consciousness onward through the stream, through the sequence of rebirths, through the process of birth and death. And so it's only with the cessation of ignorance that volitional formations come to an end. Now what happens in the case of the Arahant? Ignorance is completely eliminated. But it doesn't mean that an Arahant ceases to be active. An Arahant can be very active, only performing wholesome activities, no unwholesome activities. But these wholesome activities of the Arahant no longer create karma. They no longer have the capacity to generate new states of consciousness in future lives. And so the activities of the enlightened or liberated person do not function as sankharas, as volitional formations. They're simply activities, simply wholesome activities, but not volitional formations that create karma. Okay, so now to understand what ignorance is, then we go ahead to paragraph 66. Okay, so what is ignorance? What is the origin of ignorance? What is the cessation of ignorance? And so on. Okay, the definition of ignorance is not knowing about suffering, not knowing about the origin of suffering, not knowing about the cessation of suffering, not knowing about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So in other words, ignorance is non-knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. But what's meant by non-knowledge here is not simply lack of a conceptual or intellectual knowledge. In that case, we would, all of us who study the Four Noble Truths, we have to say, I have knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. What are they? Suffering, the origin, the cessation, the path for cessation. So I'm rid of ignorance. No need to study Buddhism anymore. No need to practice meditation anymore. I'm liberated. Go out on the streets and celebrate. And since we've all learned the Four Noble Truths together, we can all have a party to celebrate our release from ignorance. Okay, so it's not, by ignorance is not meant simply lack of an intellectual knowledge, but it's a lack of the experiential insight, direct realization, full comprehension of the Four Noble Truths. And actually, with regard to each of the Four Noble Truths, a particular function is mentioned in the text. And so with regard to the Noble Truth of Suffering, the function that has to be performed is full understanding, full comprehension. What one has to achieve is full comprehension of the Noble Truth of Suffering. With regard to the Noble Truth, the origin of suffering, which is craving, the function to be performed is eliminating craving, overcoming craving. With regard to the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, the function to be performed is realization. One has to realize the cessation of suffering. And with regard to the truth of the path, the function to be performed is development, bhavana, the full development or practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so we might say that ignorance, as long as these four functions have denying the truth of suffering. As long as one has not completely eliminated craving, then there's some degree of ignorance regarding the second noble truth, the truth of the origin or cause of suffering. As long as one has not fully realized nibbana, the cessation of suffering, then there's some degree of ignorance regarding the third noble truth. And as long as one has not completely practiced the Noble Eightfold Path through all of its stages, then there's some degree of ignorance regarding the fourth noble truth. So it's only when one fully comprehends the truth of suffering, fully eliminates craving, fully realizes Nibbana, and fully practices, develops the Noble Eightfold Path, at that point one could say ignorance is fully eliminated, fully abandoned. Okay, now ignorance brings us to the beginning of the ordinary cycle of the usual chain of dependent origination. And so we have, for this reason, 12 factors constituting the chain of dependent origination. Now I want to show you something interesting regarding the chain of conditions. When we list these conditions in this way, if you look at it, you can see that both of these lists are actually describing what is the same process, but doing so from two somewhat different angles. What I say is that the list on the left, is describing the process from maybe a more intellectual point of view, with an emphasis on ignorance as the starting point. And so it's looking at the chain of conditions, the process of birth and death, as being rooted in lack of clear knowledge, lack of understanding. And then the list on the right is describing the same process, but starting with craving. So it's taking it from a more emotional or cognitive point of view. But whenever one mentions ignorance, then we always understand that going along with ignorance, there is craving. Craving and clinging are implicit in ignorance. They're not the same as ignorance, but whenever ignorance is mentioned, craving and clinging arise from ignorance and accompany ignorance. understand that what lies behind craving and clinging is ignorance. So ignorance is also involved. Then the volitional formations we see are the volitions that create, the volitional activities that create karma. And what is meant by existence here, or bhava, according to the explanations of the commentators, are the karmic activities that create new existence, that propel the process of becoming forward into a new existence. And the new existence begins with birth and culminates in old age and death. But when there's birth, growth, aging, and death, what actually is undergoing these events? It's this interplay of consciousness and name and form. So, through birth, growth, then decay, old age, and death, it's just consciousness and name and form conditioning one another. And so we have, just in these eight factors, we have the whole process of birth and death explained. But in order to bridge the gap between name and form and craving, what the texts do is simply to draw out from name and form the factors that will lead into new craving. So from name and form, then there emerge the six sense faculties. Through the six senses, there's contact. Through the six senses, there is contact. Through contact, there is feeling. And it is feeling, especially pleasant feeling, that fuels craving, fresh craving. Okay, so this is the formula for dependent origination that we meet in many suttas, especially in Samyutta Nikaya. But now the text branches out into something which is new and I think quite unique to this sutta. Here we're still in paragraph 66. The question was raised, what is the origin of ignorance? How does ignorance begin? And then it gives the answer, with the arising of the taints, there is the arising of ignorance. With the cessation of the taints, there is the cessation of ignorance. And the way leading to the cessation of ignorance is just this noble eightfold path. Okay, so here the arising of ignorance is ascribed to what's translated as the taints. Again, I have to say, I'm not really so happy with this translation. Let's take the Pali word is asava. Outwardly, but I think the original sense is flowing inwardly, say the opposite word, are influxes? So, I don't know if that makes good sense. An influx, we have an influx of refugees. But this is an influx of certain defilements that lie deep within the mind, and I think they're perceived as flowing into active states of consciousness. And so what exactly is meant by these asavas? See, again, the text never give a real explanation of what's meant by asava. But when they raise the question, what are the asavas? They explain it simply by enumerating the particular constituent factors that are called asavas. And so we find the answer to this question in paragraph 70. There are these three taints, these three influxes: the taint of sensual desire, sensual craving; the taint of existence, which means the taint of craving for existence, craving to exist in one particular realm or another; and the taint of ignorance. And then we have here the statement, with the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of the taints. Now notice that one of the taints is the taint of ignorance, the taint of sensual desire, this is sensual craving, the taint of existence is craving for existence, and the taint of ignorance is ignorance itself. And yet, with the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of the taints. And so we see here that there's a kind of, maybe we could call this a vicious cycle, whereby ignorance gives rise to the taints, the three taints, sensual craving, craving for existence, and ignorance. And then the taints give rise to ignorance. The commentary explains that by the first mention of ignorance is the ignorance present in any given life, any given existence. The taints that cause that ignorance, the taint of ignorance among those three taints, that is the ignorance from a previous life which carried over and caused ignorance to arise again in this life. But the taint of ignorance, which comes from the previous life, was conditioned by the ignorance of the life before that. And that ignorance was conditioned by the taint of ignorance from the life before that. And so in this way, because ignorance is conditioning ignorance, the round of birth and death, the process of birth and death, is without any discoverable beginning. That's why the text speaks about samsara, the cycle of birth and death, as being without first point, without any original beginning.
Vulnerable point is ignorance itself, because
ignorance can be eliminated, it can be overcome, and it is overcome by right understanding, by true knowledge, vijja, or jnana, wisdom, or correct understanding. And so when ignorance is brought to an end through the arising of true knowledge, then all of the factors that depend upon ignorance also collapse. With the cessation of ignorance, the volitional activities cease. With the cessation of the volitional activities, there's no forward movement to new consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact, feeling. With no arising of feeling, there's no craving, no clinging, no creation of new existence, no birth, old age, and death. So that becomes the cessation of this whole round of becoming. And that cessation all comes about through the arising of wisdom, insight, true knowledge that overcomes and eradicates the darkness of ignorance. Okay, so then, just concluding in paragraph 71, Sariputta says, when a noble disciple has thus understood the taints, the origin of the taints, the cessation of the taints, and the way leading to the cessation of the taints, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. Okay, those two statements indicate or suggest the attainment of the third level of enlightenment, the level of anagami or non-return, who has eliminated sensual lust, sensual craving, and aversion or ill will. But then he goes on, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. Okay, so these phrases, extirpating the underlying tendency to the conceit I am, and abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, those phrases indicate the fourth stage of enlightenment, the stage of arahatship. So in this way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect or unshakable confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, and then that is the end of the discourse on right view. Okay, now I'll ask whether there's any questions or comments.
Living in a bundle
sometimes factor is right effort. One has to make some effort to, one has to make a very diligent effort to purify the mind and to bring into being the wholesome qualities. One has to develop right mindfulness, close, careful attention to the different factors of experience. And then one has to have right concentration to collect the mind and make it one-pointed, unified, so that we can focus closely to examine the nature of things. So all of those factors are necessary. Can one achieve Nibbana without knowing? I think it would be not be possible. But what is possible is to have an experience which is not the real experience of Nibbana, but to think that one is attaining Nibbana. Because sometimes there are very peaceful stages that can be reached, peaceful stages of meditation, and some of them can be quite stable. And so one can have quite a stable achievement of deep meditation, and think one, because of that, think one has reached Nibbana, but one hasn't actually done so. Yeah, there's a story which is actually told to illustrate this. It comes in, I think it would be Sutimaka. There was one elder monk. He was living in the south of Sri Lanka, and he thought he had achieved Nibbana or Arhatship. And he had a pupil. The pupil's name was Dhammadina. The pupil was very bright, very capable, and the pupil himself had practiced thoroughly and reached the final stage. Then the pupil, after completing his studies, he went off to another place. He was meditating in solitude. Then the thought occurred to him, has my teacher reached the goal or not? So he developed some supernormal powers, something we call iddhis. So he examined his teacher's mind, and he saw the teacher was not yet liberated. The hindrances or the mental defilements were still there, but they were just in a very quiescent state because of his skill in samadhi meditation. Okay, so Dhammadina thought, let me go and help my teacher. So he went back to visit his teacher, paid respects to him. Then he asked his teacher, when did you achieve that state? And the teacher said, oh, I reached it 10 years ago. Then Dhammadina said, did you also develop psychic powers? The teacher said, yes, I have psychic powers. Then Dhammadina said, in that case, create an element. So the teacher used the psychic power and he created an element, maybe 100 yards away. Then Dhammadina said, make the element look really fierce, really ferocious. So the teacher used his power and the elephant turned out to be really fierce and ferocious. Then Dhammadina said, make the elephant come running straight at you. So the teacher used the psychic power and the elephant started to come running straight at him. And as the elephant got, when the elephant got very close, suddenly the teacher's face turned white with fear. He turned around in order to run away. Then Dhammadina grabbed him and said, does an arhat still have fear? Then immediately the teacher realized that he was not yet liberated. Then he bowed down to his own student and said, please help me. Then Dhammadina gave him some instruction in developing insight. The teacher went off to practice and then he achieved final liberation.
The question I guess along those lines also, excuse me, is this, I see truth as being universal, so Buddhism is a methodology to reach that truth. Isn't there other methodologies, possibly other practices that would bring you to the same position, as opposed to only taking the Buddhist perspective?
Yeah, this is approach, practice that to the end.
But even in the Buddhist traditions, there's so many different approaches to this.
Well, we have to practice
all of them.
No, to find out whether different approaches can lead to the same goal, what we have to take to practice a different system, to follow each system to its final goal.
One question just occurred to me. Mentioned about anatomy and the arahant in the process of getting rid of all those hindrances here. What I sometimes have a question from my friend about the difference of arahant and samasambuddha. Can you? Well, I think we mentioned. I know Buddha is only one who arises in his.
Yep.
Besides that, in the practice,
yep.
What is the difference?
Okay, there are certain, let's say that both the Arhat and the Buddha, the Sammasambuddha, are alike with regard to their liberation. They're both completely liberated from all defilements, both liberated from the cycle of birth, aging, and death. But a Buddha achieves, first he achieves enlightenment without any guidance or instruction from others. So he is the finder of the way, the discoverer of the path, the one who finds the path without receiving instructions in it from anybody else. Okay, then a Buddha also possesses certain powers or faculties of knowledge which are not shared by others. These are considered unique qualities of a unique qualities of a perfectly enlightened Buddha. Among these are the 10 Tathagata powers. A few of them are shared by Arhat disciples, but about 6 or 7 are unique to a Buddha. Then there are the 4 grounds of self-confidence. Then there's the physical features, the 32 marks of the great man. And then later texts began creating lists of other qualities that are special to the Buddha. And the Buddha also has special capacities as a teacher to be able to know exactly, or at least to know the best way to teach those who come to him, to teach in a way which is exactly suited to that, to the needs, the capacity, the aptitude of the disciple. Whereas arhats often don't have that ability. But we'll come to this question towards the end of the book. We'll take it in greater detail. But that's just a brief answer.
Bhante, how would I know if I meet a monk, if he says he has attained arhatship, how would I know someone who would not know much? Since I have met someone like that last year, and I had a lot of doubts.
Probably it's not possible to know with absolute certainty, but what one does would be to look to see whether one doesn't want to be suggesting any of the faults. But if one sees any traces of greed, of selfishness, craving, that's a disqualification. Any traces of anger, hatred, bias, that would be a disqualification. Any traces of pride, arrogance, that would be a disqualification. One can mention the disqualifications, but one can't say how one can know with absolute certainty. But also one has to remember that even people who are quite earnest, sincere, as practitioners, often have their own personal faults. So don't start thinking that if you examine a monk, think, is he a harlot or is he a then you see maybe when eating, he goes for a particular type of sweet, that he likes, ask for a second serving of ice cream. Sometimes gets a little annoyed, then thinking, ah, he's worthless.
I thought you would say the answer was find an elephant from the elephant story.
Yeah. And test it. Bring an elephant into the room.
So